It's good to be back. However, I realize that when you're gone for 2 weeks and your routine changes as drastically as mine did, it takes a while to start the old engine again. You know, you go from sitting on the back porch on a swing holding a one-year-old, cooing, making funny noises that most often we don't make, and looking at books that rhyme about things that don't mean a whole lot. Changing diapers. I only did that once, right, dear? I had to do it, though, just to prove that I could still do it. The family kind of challenged me. They said, "Oh, Grandpa, can you still change diapers?" And I said, "You bet I can. Come on, bring that kid over here, you know." And you get those diapers changed. But the diapers are different now than they used to be. So I kind of, there's a little bit of a learning curve. But I did it. I did it. But it's a wonderful thing to visit our family and to see your children grow up and have little kids, and to suddenly realize that at 55 you're a grandfather. You never dreamt you would ever be a grandfather, much less at 55. But I can tell you one thing: it's a good thing. It's a wonderful thing. And I thank God for our children. I thank God for our little grandson, who is just about ready to walk. He's still not quite sure. He wants to let go of your hand and step out on his own. But I think within a week or two, I think we're going to get a phone call saying, "You know, Sean's walking now," because he's one lively kid, full of energy, charging around the house on his hands and knees. And then when he's not on his hands and knees, he's up, you know, holding on to things and running around the house and into everything, pulling things out of, you know, closets, pulling things out of bookshelves, off the top of, you know, everything, just making a general mess. But we love him, and it's hard to say no to a one-year-old that's so full of energy. But sometimes we have to do that, because that's the only way kids learn that there are boundaries in life. And that starts at 1 year old. I didn't realize that. 1 year old, you already have to start setting boundaries. But he's got good parents, and we're just praying that God will continue to lead them. But it's good to be back. Good to be back, and to see your smiling faces, and back with the family of God. You know, take a moment and just turn to somebody next to you or greet somebody next to you and just welcome them this morning. I think that's good. Just need to lighten up a little. I'm not wearing a tie today on purpose, so that we can just relax a little. Sometimes we get a little stuffy, don't we? So this morning, we're not going to be stuffy, all right? You want to take your shoes off, you go ahead and do that. You want to take your tie off, you can do that too. I decided not to wear one this morning. It's summer. And I think sometimes we just need to sort of relax a little. And as we come into God's presence, we've felt His Holy Spirit here this morning. And now as we open His Word and we can learn from His Word, I just pray that our hearts will be open, our minds will be in tune with God's Word this morning. We're back in the book of Exodus again, and I've been enjoying this walk through the Bible, through the different lives of the individuals, the men and women, the great men and women of the Bible. And as I was studying the next chapter, actually I was going to move on to 19 and 20, and I realized that I wasn't done yet with chapter 18. Because in chapter 18 we have an interesting story that has some incredible lessons that we can learn as we live our lives here on this earth. And Exodus chapter 18 is the story of Moses reconnecting with his father-in-law. Now, we don't know a whole lot about his father-in-law. We know that he was a priest of Midian. We know that he was a gracious man, because he was willing to take Moses in when he was a stranger out wandering in the desert. He was gracious enough to give him a place to stay, gave him a job, and then eventually gave him his daughter to be a wife. So we know that this man was a man of principle. We know that this man was a virtuous man. He was a man who had a tremendous strength within him and a lot of wisdom. And I can't help but believe that as Moses lived in that home in the same family of Jethro, that he learned tremendous lessons at the feet of his father-in-law Jethro. It's, as I said, there's not a whole lot said about Jethro, but what we do know about him is that he was a virtuous man. And so Moses, in this story here in chapter 18, has gone from the land of Egypt. He has brought the children of Israel out of Egypt. God has performed mighty miracles. God has used Moses in a mighty way to lead these people out of slavery towards the promised land. Incredible events have taken place. The Egyptian army was virtually crushed. The Pharaoh was destroyed. The water was provided where there was no water. Food was provided when there was no food. And all of this, in all of this, Moses could have easily said, "Wow, look at me. Finally, it's about time that people paid attention to me. After all, I'm this great leader. I was this great man who tried to start a revolt many years ago, but it failed. But now, finally, you know, I have God behind me, and wow, look what I've done. Look what I'm doing." But that is not the spirit of Moses. Because Moses had learned from the experiences of life. He had learned from not only the hardships of his life, but from the good times. He had learned from the wisdom of other people. And so when his father says, "Hey," sends a message, "Moses, I'm coming, I'm bringing your children and your wife to you," Moses goes out, it says, to meet him. And what is the first thing he does to his father-in-law? Get my glasses out of here. What is the first thing? When he meets his father-in-law in chapter 18, in verse 7, it says, "So Moses went out to meet his father-in-law and bowed down, and he kissed him." He bowed down. This is the great Moses. This is the leader of the children of Israel. This is the one who has performed so many incredible miracles. This is the one who God had chosen. And yet he was humbled. He was humble enough to bow down and show respect to his father-in-law, which says a lot to me. It says that not only was Moses a great leader, not only was Moses a humble leader, but also Moses was one who valued the wisdom of another person. Now, after he bows down, he invites his father, he greets his family. He invites his father-in-law into the camp. And he begins to tell his father-in-law all the incredible stories of how God had rescued the children of Israel on their way to the mountain of God, to Mount Sinai. All the incredible acts of God. And he shares these stories. And I can imagine as the two sat there and Moses shared these stories, Jethro's eyes must have gotten bigger and bigger. Incredible. Moses, is that really what happened? You mean you just stretched out your arm and the sea parted and you walked through on dry land? Unbelievable. And you mean God provided water where there was no water and he gave you food when there was no food? Can you imagine the dialogue that went on between that father and that son-in-law? They must have had a good relationship. They must have loved each other deeply and respected each other. And the Bible tells us that the next day Moses began to sit and listen to the concerns of the camp. Moses, of course, was not only the leader, but he was also the judge. He was also the spiritual leader. He was the one that gave people counsel. And Jethro, his father-in-law, was sitting watching. And the man that he was, a man of great strength, a man of great wisdom, a man of great experience, he began to realize that Moses was in trouble. There was a problem. But I don't want to focus so much on the story of chapter 18 because basically I've told most of it just in a few moments here. But I want to focus on something that I sense and that I see in this story, and that is that Jethro was a virtuous man. Now, when I use the word virtue, what does that mean to you? What does it mean to be virtuous? Good, faithful, okay? Obedient. Do I have to be a religious person to be virtuous? No. Do I have to be a Christian to be virtuous? Can I be a Buddhist and be virtuous? Sure. Being virtuous is aside from being holy and righteous and religious. Virtue is something that, if we were to look at the life of Jethro and of Moses, we will see that they were virtuous men. Magnificent moral moments often move us to tears. Have you ever been in an experience that was so incredible, that it was so powerful that it moved you to tears? I remember the first time I heard that the great speech that Martin Luther King Jr. gave there in Washington, D.C., I Have a Dream. It was in a class at La Sierra, and my teacher, Charles Teal, had a copy of that. He had told us all about that experience. He marched with Martin Luther there in Washington, right in the front row with him, because he believed in what Martin Luther King was doing. He believed it was right. He believed it was moral. And he told us this story, and then he played the soundtrack of that speech, I Have a Dream. I Have a Dream. And as I listened to that voice, so full of passion, so full of strength and courage, tears came to my eyes. And every time when I hear that speech again, even if it's just a small segment of that speech, I get a lump in my throat. It was a great moment. It was a magnificent moral moment in the history of America. Sometimes those great moments in our lives change our lives. And I've said this before, and I'll share it again. I remember when my first son was born, it was like I was struck with a bolt of lightning. It just hit me as to what was taking place right before my eyes. That I was now a father. That I was now going to be looked up to. That I was now in charge of making sure that this young child, this little baby, this little pink infant, was going to be raised with good values and good morals. Suddenly I realized that I was going to have to change my life. There were things in my life that I did not want him to copy. There were things that I said I did not want him to copy. It's interesting, I just discovered, spending 2 weeks with my son up there, that he had a similar experience. Maybe he hasn't verbalized it, but I noticed that there's a change in him. My son was, he was your typical high school, college sports, he's a jock, he was always in the middle of whatever was happening on campus if it had to do with sports. And he prided himself in his machoism and his strength and his physical abilities and his in the sports arena. And I just, for some reason, could not picture him holding a little tiny baby and nurturing that baby somehow. That, holding a football and a basketball, yes, but a baby, somehow in my mind, I could not picture that. But I am so proud of my son, because my son has changed, and he loves that little guy. He tells us all the time how much he loves little Sean. Every time he calls my wife and I, he says, "Oh, I love my little baby so much." Something has changed. An experience in his life has brought about a change in his life. The words he used to use when he stubbed his toe, he doesn't use anymore. We saw several examples of that. We want to be virtuous people, don't we? Don't we want to? Don't we want to pass on to our young people and our children good values, good moral standards? We want that, don't we? Dr. Eric Erickson, who studied the development of children and human development over years, said this thing: men have always shown a dim knowledge of their better potentialities by paying homage to those purest leaders who taught the simplest and most inclusive rules for an undivided mankind. So often we look to other people and we say, there is a good man, there is a good woman. I wish I could be like them. I wish I was as virtuous as they were. Well, if that's true, if all of us down deep in our hearts want to be virtuous people, if this nature exists within us, then why is it so seldom shown? And why is it so hard to live the virtuous life? So much of what we dwell upon in this world, and especially here in America, is the dark side, the shadowy side, the twisted side of society. What do you read about in the news? You know, what do we read about? We read about violence. We read about destruction and death and sickness and disease and wars and rumors of wars and all these things that the media just loves to soak up. So few times do we hear about people who do unbelievable things, people of deep moral strength. And when we do, we're stricken by it. And like the men that piloted those planes on September 11, who were acting in obedience to their religion, we see that fanatical ideas can cause horrible, unthinkable tragedies. I don't know if I need to remind you, but we can think about Holocausts. We can think about genocides that are taking place right now around the world. We can talk about Jim Jones. We can talk about Waco's. We can talk about Timothy McVeigh's and Unabomber's and O.J. Simpson's. And that is what we tend to listen to a lot. And yet from the dark shadows of the difficult and the pain and the suffering and the darkness of life, there walk men and women of virtue, ready to stand for a higher standard, unflinching commitment to doing what is morally right, and willing to die for what they believe. Men like Gandhi, Martin Luther King Jr., Florence Nightingale, Corrie ten Boom. There are many hundreds and thousands of men and women, some unmentioned, some even unknown, who have given their lives and dedicated their lives to believing and practicing moral issues. One example that some of you may have never heard about, I recently heard about this. I did not. I know I've heard the story many times and have read about it, but I did not understand the magnitude of this act. Officer Hugh Thompson, a man of obviously a virtuous man, a man of deep moral values, in March 16, 1968. Was hovering above a terrible scene below him, the May Lai, the massacre at May Lai, as he watched American soldiers chasing innocent victims and shooting them down in cold blood. And even after people were wounded and laying on the ground, going up and shooting them, he became incensed and enraged, and he flew his helicopter down between the American soldiers and the Vietnamese in May Lai, and he ordered his machine gunner to shoot any American that ever attempted and tried to kill another Vietnamese. This man was a man of deep moral courage. And so we are reminded that even in the darkest hours of this world's history, there are people who are willing to stand for what is right. They are men and women of virtue. Who are these? And why are these heroes, we would call them, so different? They are different because they are people who have developed a moral code that they live by and are willing to die for. They do not just blindly follow a set of rules. They live by a set of values that has given them the strength to do what is right, even when it's not popular, even in the face of possibly being killed themselves. As I was thinking and reading these stories and reflecting upon experiences in my life and experiences that I've observed and read about, I realized that these are individuals who understood this one principle. And I want you to listen carefully and follow. Rules tell us what we should and shouldn't do. You would agree with that, right? But rules cannot teach us necessarily about virtue. Rules can tell us about virtue. They can tell us about virtue, but they do not show us how to be virtuous. Okay? How is that so? Well, as we look at the life of Jethro and the life of Moses, we realize that virtue takes time. It takes experience. It takes failures. It takes suffering to develop a virtuous person. Obeying rules leads often to the creation of a culture of obedience. And I have to say, as I was studying for this, I came across a number of articles that talked about the culture of obedience. And I want you to follow with me here, because some of you are saying, oh no, here we go, look out. Pastor Munson's saying, you know, that you don't have to follow rules. It's not what I'm saying. I'm trying to develop a thought, a concept here. I want you to follow carefully, because all of us have fallen into this trap before. But simply obeying rules for the sake of obeying rules does not make you a good person or a moral person or a virtuous person. Okay? It's called the culture of obedience. And ironically, that concept was referred to time and time again as I was studying my material for this week. It also leads to cultic thinking and moral totalism, which was interesting, because several of the authors referred to this culture of obedience was what led to Hitler's ability to control an entire nation. Unbelievable. It's this culture of obedience, obeying just to be obedient, that led people to follow David Koresh to a flaming death. It was this culture of obedience that led people to mindlessly follow Jim Jones into Guyana and to die in the jungles by drinking poisonous Kool-Aid. People mindlessly repeating things over and over and over and not even knowing why they are doing it. Today, more than ever, we need people and men and women of virtue and strong character. Sociologists and psychologists are telling us today we are a mindless culture. Whatever the latest whim that Hollywood produces, we follow it. When David Letterman cracks jokes about Sarah Palin's daughter, we laugh at them. We think it's hilarious. Not even stopping to think of what a terrible thing he said. Virtuous people are people that are mindful of the decisions that they make in their life. They are mindful and aware and alive and in tune with what's going on in the world around them. So how do we go about becoming virtuous? After reading all the material that I was reading in preparation, the first thing that came into my mind is, yes, I want to be that. I want to be a virtuous person. So how do we then become a virtuous person? Being virtuous is a process that takes thought, time, and practice. Colossians chapter 3, if you want to turn with me. The New Testament, Colossians, the third chapter. The Apostle Paul. By the way, the idea of virtue, being virtuous, is very, very old concept. It was developed by Socrates and Thomas Aquinas and Aristotle and some of the early philosophers and theologians. So it's not something that's new. It's something that's very old, but is very important to us as human beings. In the Apostle Paul, in Colossians, the third chapter, verse 12, he says, therefore, as God's chosen people, holy and dearly loved. You're dearly loved this morning. Did you know that? Amen. And you're dearly loved, and you're holy. You're holy before God because you're God's children. That doesn't automatically make you virtuous, though. Therefore, as God's chosen people, holy and dearly loved, clothe yourselves Here we go now. You want to know what a virtuous person is and does? They're compassionate. Okay? They're kind. They're humble. They're gentle. And they're patient. And they're long-bearing and long-suffering. And they forgive one another their grievances. And verse 14, and over all these virtues, what does it say? Put on love. Now, this is not a list of do's and don'ts. This is not a magical formula for becoming perfect or sinless. As I said earlier, you don't have to be a Christian or someone who believes in God or the Bible to be virtuous. The Apostle Paul here, though, is reminding us that part of being a Christian, a follower of God, being holy and acceptable, means that we live a virtuous life. It's a given. It's not a command. And so, the first thing that popped into my mind, you know, the commercial that started off, it used to be Got Milk. And people have used that now for lots of other things. Got Sand, Got Beer, Got whatever they got, whatever you got, okay. But I thought, for Christians, it should be Get Wisdom, okay? You want to be a virtuous person? Get Wisdom. Well, you're saying, well, why isn't Get God first? Well, sometimes the first step towards God is to realize that you need wisdom in order to even step forward into a relationship with God. Proverbs chapter 4, verse 7 says, get wisdom. It's the wisest thing you can do. Get wisdom. It's the wisest thing you can do. What's the wisest thing you can do? Get wisdom. And I'd like to suggest that in getting wisdom, when you get wisdom, you also have to get the twin sister of wisdom, and it's called humility. I have never met in my life a truly wise person that wasn't, first of all, a humble person. Oh, there's a lot of cocky people that think they know it all. They think they've got the answers. They think they're wise. They always have an answer for everything. But I don't see them as wise people because they're not humble. Humility is the twin of wisdom. Because when somebody is truly wise, they are someone who has listened to others who are wise. They have sought out the wisdom of others. But ultimately, they have sought out the wisdom from God. Proverbs 9, chapter 10 says, fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. First, we must get wisdom because it is the wisest thing that we can do. And in the process of that, the true wisdom comes from God. By the way, the idea of fear here in chapter 9 of Proverbs is worship. It's in the context of worship. Just a little sideline. Worship Him, respect Him, and love Him. Love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and thy soul and thy mind. And secondly, love your neighbor as yourself. True wisdom, true spiritual wisdom, is living life according to God's point of view, not our point of view. Got it? True wisdom is living our lives according to God's point of view, with God's values, and in God's time. I keep talking about time, and this is where I want the kids to look alive and wake up. There are virtuous young people and virtuous children. But the one thing you will learn the older you get is that you are not the total sum of all wisdom, especially teenagers. Ever met an 18-year-old? And I'm not going to trash 18-year-olds. I just want you to know I was once an 18-year-old, and I knew it all. I was the total sum of all wisdom. Nobody could tell me anything. My parents couldn't tell me anything. The principal couldn't tell me anything. The police couldn't tell me anything. Nobody could tell me anything because I had it all together. And then after that, I went on a slippery slide slope to the age of 55, where at 55 I realized that I know very little. But I don't go to 18-year-olds to find a whole lot of wisdom. And it's not because they're not wonderful people, it's not because they're not sweet people, it's not because they're not Christian people, it's because time has yet to teach them what wisdom truly is. You got it? So if you're 18, God bless you. Give yourself a couple years, and you'll be on the same slide that I've been on. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. To worship God is to be wise. Why is it important to worship God? Because it's the beginning of wisdom. And so we humble ourselves before God because we realize that we are not the total sum of all wisdom, that we need a loving, caring God, a God who can save us from ourselves. Number three. Number one, get wisdom. Number two, get God. Number three, get teachable. All right? Be teachable. Accept advice and listen to the wise ones around you. Listen to those who have more experience. Listen to those who can teach you from their own experience so that you won't have to go through the hard times like they did. That's the biggest struggle as an adult parent for me is to somehow try to convey to my kids, my boys, the lessons they need to learn without sounding like I know it all, but also letting them know that I've been through those experiences and I don't want them to go through them too. That's hard. Proverbs chapter 12. Some words from the wisest man that ever lived, which is even questionable. I think if you were alive today, you'd go, man, why'd you guys brand me with that one? Because I believe that Solomon was a humble man at times in his life, as we all are. Proverbs chapter 12, verse 15 says, "The way of a fool seems right to him." Don't you like that? It seems right to him. You ever met somebody like that? The ways of a fool seems right to him, but what? But a wise man listens to advice. Young people, please listen to advice. Listen to advice. Okay? Proverbs 13, verse 10. I found all kinds of stuff about wisdom in Solomon's writings, obviously. Chapter 13, verse 10 says, "Pride only breeds quarrels, but wisdom is found in those..." Listen, what? Those who take advice. You ever been around somebody who can't take advice? It's frustrating. It's very frustrating. And they know it all, and they have the answer for everything. And you can't even... I remember a couple years ago, I was counseling this individual, and their biggest problem was they just didn't have a realistic view of who they were. And they knew it all, though. And I began to realize that this was a pattern in their lives that had existed ever since they were young, maybe even since they were infants, that somehow they had become the center of the universe, and their parents had told them that, and their teachers had told them that, and now the universe and the world around them was crashing in, and they didn't want to listen. And after counseling this individual for it was about a month, I gave them one piece of advice. I told them, first of all, I don't have the answer. I don't know how to help you, but there's one thing that you can do, that is to go back and begin to listen to the advice of your parents. Good parents, wonderful Christian people. Piaget would tell us that a person that is not able to take advice is a person who has never developed past the age of two. Because the whole world revolves around them. And somehow they got that message and were never told anything else. And so they live in misery. And nobody wants to tell them because they're afraid that they'll rage or yell or scream or holler at them. But wisdom, wisdom comes from listening and observing and experiencing life. Okay, now, when I talk about virtue here, I want to emphasize again. I want you to listen carefully. When you talk about a virtuous person, you are not talking about perfectionism or sinlessness. Okay? That is not what I'm talking about. That is not what the Bible's talking about. To live virtuously is to simply live a life consistent with what you believe. Okay? And I know that's tough because some have not stopped to think about what they believe. They just go with the flow, slide through the mud. Everybody else is doing it. Why can't I? You need to stop and think and decide what it is you believe. Be virtuous. Now listen to this. And I went through several different documents and articles and two books that talked about this. And this was the bottom line. Be virtuous. Listen to this. Be virtuous by living virtuously. Does that sound oversimplified? Be virtuous by living virtuously. In other words, make decisions based on what you believe and then stick with it. That's being virtuous. And then here's another one. And this is so simple that it blew my mind. And I had to go back and read it over and over and over again. And it may blow your mind, and you may walk out of here today and you're going to be thinking about it all week, and you're going to come back and you're going to maybe ask me, what did you mean by this? But I'm not going to go into a lengthy explanation. I want you to think about this in the total sum of what we have said this morning and what we have studied this morning, the life of Jethro and Moses, these great men of virtue, these great men of God. And think about this. Living the right way is far more important than knowing the right way to live. Woo, that's a twist, isn't it? Can we hear that again, Pastor Munson? You bet. I want it to sink in. I want you to go away with your mind spinning. What in the world does that mean? Living the right way is far more important than knowing the right way to live. God wants us as Christians to be men and women of virtue. Men and women, as the Apostle Paul says in Colossians, who treat each other kindly, who treat others in a kind way, and most importantly of all, put on love. Put on love.